o'clock.
All right. Good evening, everyone. Thanks for coming. We're in the fourth year of our series on the history of the Talmud. Just a quick review of what we've done until now. We started with a discussion of basically the breakdown of classical religious halachic bureaucracy and structure that went on from the breakdown first of the Anshei Knesset HaGdola, followed the men of the Great Assembly, followed by ultimately the infiltration, or what seems to be the infiltration of the Sanhedrin by Rome and by Roman sympathizers. We saw the argument between Hillel and Menachem. And then last week we did the Shammai-Hillel controversy, how the Shammai and Hillel, the two houses, and the arguments between them and the conflict that existed between them was very much an outgrowth of the lack of a central institution by which all these decisions could be made. And again, this new halachic world order that was created by the failure of a bureaucratic system, I guess we can relate to it today, right, that when there is a breakdown of centralized government, anarchy rules. So here you had a breakdown of centralized halacha, and because of that, it gave people much more freedom than they had in the past. It also, there were advantages to it. The advantages to it were that all of a sudden, more people had access to the ins and outs of the oral law, that now it demystified, so to speak, a lot of the Talmudic discussions that we've become so used to and so second nature. To people then, it wasn't necessarily things that they knew, that they were aware of. There was no Talmud written. All of this stuff was kept orally. So they didn't necessarily know all of these things. So how can you say that it was bad from that perspective? It gave people a lot of insight into it. And the person who was probably, I guess, the George Washington, so to speak, of Talmudic discussion in terms of bringing it to the people was the very patient and open-minded Hillel. Hillel, who was able to a certain extent, create such a bit of a comfort with the new cultural milieu that was being created by Roman infiltration and Roman influence, yet at the same time retain that intensive commitment to halachic reasoning. And that's why Hillel, we see particularly with the event of the Korban Pesach, with the event of the Paschal sacrifice, he said they didn't know what to do on Shabbos Erev Pesach, how they would bring the sacrifice when Erev Pesach falls on Shabbos, and Hillel was able to demystify it from a number of different perspectives, and that seems, I think, to be symbolic of the new world order or the new perspective on halacha that was being created. Our next issue that we're going to deal with is the children of Hillel and the advent of the Rabban. So what does that mean? So until Hillel's children, and it's unclear whether, so Hillel has a child by the name of Shimon, who's known in various places as either Shimon Ish HaMitzvah or Shimon Beno, Shimon his son. And Shimon has a son by the name of Gamliel. Gamliel is one of three Gamliels that we're going to be introduced to. All of them influential and important. He's called either Gamliel HaZaken, right? The elder, Gamliel the elder, meaning he's the first, just like Hillel is called Hillel HaZaken. His grandchild is called Gamliel the second. I mean, for lack of a better way of calling him. What's fascinating, and I think this is just worth a little bit of thinking about, is the name Hillel is never used again amongst the grandchildren. I personally just think that's a little bit fascinating. And what's my conclusion, or what's my speculation, I should say? What is my speculation about why the name Hillel is never used again? That sometimes some characters are so significant, so unique to their generation, so unique to history, that maybe they didn't think that anyone would ever again live up to that name, would ever measure up to that name. So this is what we're going to deal with. And Rabban Gamliel, or Gamliel the Elder, Gamliel HaZaken, is the first one who uses a new terminology, a terminology that's never been used before. In fact, they're never, if you look, they're hardly ever using the title Rav. Hillel isn't called Rav Hillel. He's just called Hillel. Yossi ben Yoezer, Yossi ben Yochanan, Shmaya v'Avtalion, Shimon ben Shetach. None of them are called in rabbinic texts by any title. All of a sudden, not necessarily Hillel's son, but Hillel's grandson is given this newfangled title of Rabban, right? Which we've never seen before. And I think that's why I called this shir the Rabban, because I feel like that title is symbolic of a historically significant moment in Jewish history. It's a moment when, again, this new type of leadership is starting to solidify.
Rabban literally means our rabbi?
Yeah, Rabban, our rabbi. It's an Aramaic terminology. All right, so let's start with the first source. It's Gemara in Shabbos. So Shimon ben Hillel is a very easy person to explore. Why is he an easy person to explore? There are scant references to him, shall I say, in the Talmud and in rabbinic literature. I think there's only three or four. So I brought, I think, the lion's share of them. So the first one is the Gemara in Shabbos. Daf Tesvav Amin Aleph 15a says as follows. Hillel v'Shimon ben Gamliel v'Shimon nahagu nisiusan lifnei habayis. So here it's making a historical point. Hillel, Shimon, Gamliel, and Shimon, so four generations of the Hillel family, all practiced their leadership or took on their role as nasi, as de facto or de jure, unclear, religious leader, before the 100 years before the Beis HaMikdash was destroyed. Hence, 30 BCE is the rise of Hillel, 70 CE, the destruction of the temple, is when Rabbi Shimon II is killed somehow during the great revolt and the destruction of the temple. The Ilu Yossi ben Yoezer, Ishtreda v'Yossi ben Yochan, Havu Kadmai Tuva. Yossi ben Yoezer and Yossi ben Yochanan, Havu Kadmai Tuva, they were much earlier. So they were earlier than 30 CE. So we get this kind of little piece of historical information. Okay? If you look back, to the leaders of the Sanhedrin that we've seen so far, what is unique about Hillel, Shimon, Gamliel, and Shimon?
Are they members of Hillel?
Well, they're all Nisiim.
Four generations.
Have any of the other Nisiim been children of prior Nisiim? The answer is no. What you have here, what do we call that?
Dynasty.
When, first of all, Judaism, except for monarchy in halachic leadership, has never had a monarchic type of rule like that, a dynastic rule. And all of a sudden, you have this dynasty. A dynasty that, by the way, is going to continue into the Babylonian period. The exilarch, you know, the Resh Galuta, who, you know, we still say a blessing for him every Shabbos, right? Yikum Porkan, you know, what would we do if we didn't bless the exilarch every Shabbos? Who knows what he would do to us, right? So every Shabbos, we still, that's amazing. All of a sudden, you have this dynastic rule that never existed before, right? So that's really interesting. At least four generations until the destruction of the temple, and then what happens? We're going to find out. Gamliel II, right? He is going to end up taking on the leadership in Yavne. We're going to find out a lot about him because there's a ton of information about Gamliel II. And he's really a reformer in terms of creating post temple Judaism, but Gamliel II, he's hidden and protected by Rav Yochanan ben Zakkai in order that he should be able to take the leadership of the Jewish people. I mean, that's fascinating. When have we ever done that? What do you mean? Who's the Rosh Yeshiva? Not the child of the Rosh Yeshiva. The new Rosh Yeshiva is the starkest guy in the Beis Medrash, right? You're not gonna choose someone merely because he's the child. You know, that was one of the criticisms of early Hasidus. What? How do you know the Rebbe's son is going to be worthy of being the Rebbe?
Often he wasn't.
Yochanan
ben Zakkai was the head of the
Sanhedrin. Yochanan ben Zakkai is the leader of the Jewish people after the destruction of the temple. We're going to discuss him, but he's kind of a transitional leader. They go back to Rabbi Gamliel. Okay. There's no like, oh, maybe Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai's son should take over, or maybe Rabbi Akiva should take over. And even then, you'll see that when they kick out Rabbi Gamliel, there's a little bit of anxiety about kicking out someone who was at least known to be a descendant of David HaMelech. You know, so that's kind of interesting there. So there are two sources here about who Rabbi Shimon was. So Mishnah, Maseches Peah, Perek Beis, Mishnah Vav.
Question, can I have a question?
Yes.
Why did they mention this Yossi ben Yazir?
They were two previous leaders of the Sanhedrin. Okay, the Gemara is making a historical point here.
Why is it making historical? Since when is the
Gemara? It's part of the discussion there. They just wanted to know when things were said. Yeah, I'm taking it out of context just for my own purposes here. Okay. Yeah. All right. So the Mishnah Maseches Peah Perek Beis Mishnah Vav says Maaseh, a certain event, Shezar Rabbi Shimon Isha Mitzvah Lifnei Rama Gamliel. So Rabbi Shimon of Mitzvah, so he was planting before Rabban Gamliel, Valula Lishkas HaGazis, right? They went up to Lishkas HaGazis, which we said was the place, that was the offices of the Sanhedrin. Vishalu Amar Nacham Halavlar. So he says, so Nacham Halavlar, who was there, says Mukabal ani me Rabbi Miasha Shekibel Miaba Shekibel Min Azugos Shekiblu Min Anisim Halacha Moshe Misinai. So apparently the case here was some sort of Kilayim case of where they plant two things together, right? So he says I have a tradition from a tradition going back all the way to the prophets that when you plant two types of wheat together. Im asan gorinachas, if you gather them all together, so this in terms of leaving for the poor people, nosin peachas shtei granos nosin shtei peos. We, even though, if you view it as two separate fields, you have to leave two separate corners. Okay, why am I interested in this? I'm interested in this is because where was Rabban Gamliel and where is Rabbi Shimon? They're not in the Sanhedrin.
Outside.
They're outside the Sanhedrin. Right, they're not inside of it. Okay, so we get here this kind of little bit of information here. Another, the Gemara in Yuma, the next source, Yuma Daf Yudalit Amud Beis, right? Amar Rav Huna Man Tana Tamid, who was the Tana, the Mishnaic scholar who put together the Mishnah of Tamid about the daily sacrifice. Who was that? Shimon Ish Hamitzvah. That was Rabbi Shimon. Right, who seems to be the son of Hillel. Okay, so we see here Hillel, Shimon ben Hillel, a minor character in rabbinic literature, hardly ever heard from. But what's interesting is he's not a member of the Sanhedrin, even though he's viewed as a leader, and neither is his son, Rabban Gamliel, who is viewed very much as a leader. So that's kind of interesting. So number one is I'll give you Rav Ruvain Margoliot, who a fascinating individual just in general to hear about. Rav Ruvain Margoliot was the librarian at the Tel Aviv University Library, and also the most encyclopedic man probably who ever existed. And he wrote a number of very, very important works. One on a commentary on Sanhedrin called Margoliot Hayam. Again, fascinating just in terms of its breadth of scholarship. And another very, very thin book, and one which unfortunately has not been translated into English, called Yesod HaMishnah V'Arichata. Basically, it's a book on how the Mishnah came to be written. And if you're wondering where I get my sources, so I could give a shiur on each footnote in this book. Okay? This is the way it works. He'll make like a one-line claim. This is his one-line claim. His one-line claim that he makes is that Hillel had an exceptionally long tenure as leader of the Jewish people, and that's why his son Shimon had an extraordinarily short leadership. And what does he do? He quotes now 500 sources, zam, okay, that support that one line. Every one of them basically supporting the notion that Hillel had a very, very long career, just considering how much influence he had. And that Shimon, did he die young? Did he, you know, what were the reasons? Was, you know, were they not writing so many stuff down that during those days? For whatever reason, he was very much, he lived in a very, very long shadow. And that was the long shadow of Hillel. So he never really got to shine. That being said, his son, Gamliel HaZaken, really does shine. And one of the things I want to point out about Gamliel HaZaken as we read him, is I want when we read a little bit about Gamliel HaZaken, I want you to notice in which areas he's acting, in which religious areas and political areas he's acting, and how he's acting in those areas. Okay, so we'll start, and also take note of the fact that he is the first one who is consistently referred to by the title of Rabban. Right? Not Rabbi, not Rabbi, not Rav, not just by his first name, but by Rabban. Okay, yes, sir. Ah, so that's going to be my claim now. That the title Rabban is symbolic or is a statement about a new type of non-bureaucratic leadership. The Gadol Hador. You know, he is the Gadol Hador. He's our rabbi. And for the first time now, you get the notion of a rabbi. Right? Beforehand, what were they? He was a congressman. Right? Not necessarily an elected official, but a chosen official. And again, in Judaism, nobility was chosen not by inheritance, but by Torah scholarship. And that's the way you got elected to Congress. You were chosen because of your scholarship. So that's the way it happened. But now, the Sanhedrin, once it's no longer an institution populated solely by religious Jews, and once it's no longer a organization that is dominated totally by halachis and people committed to Torah Shabbat Peh, people committed to the oral law, all of a sudden you've created a need for a new institution, a central halachic figure who's going to basically work within and without of the system. And that's one of the things I want to point out about Rabban Gamliel. We're going to see him doing things that are both political and religious in nature, and it's going to be clear that he's not working within the organized system of the Sanhedrin, but he's working without. So just to give a couple of sources here. Okay? So number one is the Mishnah Meseches Orla, Perek Beis, Mishnah Yud Beis. Yoezer Ish Habira Hayami Talmidei Beis Shammai. So this guy, Yoezer, who was one of the students of Beis Shammai, and again, it's not until Rabban Gamliel II that they're actually going to make a decision on who we're going to hold, like Beis Shammai or Beis Hillel, so both are still floating around there. V'amar sha'alti es Rabban Gamliel hazakein, omeid b'shar ha-mizrach. Where I find Rabban Gamliel? I found him in the Eastern Gate, not in the Lishkas HaGazis. Right? And they had a question, particularly about chametz. He answers the question for him about chametz. So that's, again, the technical halachic issue I'm not so interested in right now. What my point is, where is he? He's paskening shailas, not from the Lishkas HaGazis, not from a conversation with various rabbanim, but what's he doing as his status as Gadol Ha'ir, Gadol Hador, whatever you want to call it. But as that status, he is now dealing with various questions that are there. Second Gemara, Gemara Shabbos Daf Kuf Tes Vav Amin Aleph, Shabbos 116a. So here it tells a story, Maisa. So Amar Rabbi Yossi says, Maisa ba'Abba Chalafta, so a certain guy named Abba Chalafta, Shalach Eitzel Rabban Gamliel Beribi Litaveria. So Abba Chalafta went to go see Rabban Gamliel III, right? The son of Rebbe, the son of Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi. He's a descendant of a descendant of a descendant. Okay, and what do you have? He was sitting there learning Tanakh, and he was learning an Aramaic translation of the book of Job. That's what he was learning. Vuhu korebo, and he's reading it. Amar lo. So it says, Abba Chalaftu is apparently a very elderly person. Zechor ani b'Rabba Gamliel avi avicha. I remember the Alta Alter Rabban Gamliel, right? That what? Shaya omed al gabi male bahar abayis. That what was he doing? He was standing on some sort of raised platform on Har Abayis, not in the Lishkas HaGazis. Okay? V'yevil afan of Sefer Eov Targum, and they brought him the Aramaic translation of Job. V'amar libnai shakeu tachas hanidbach afu shakeu tachas hanidbach. And what did he do? He said to his son, go put it in Gniza. You know, go bury it. Meaning, it was an inappropriate text. Either it was written by a heretic, it was written by someone who was, you know, influenced by other opinions, whatever it is. So this Rabban Gamliel, he responds to this, oh, taka, probably bad read. So he puts his commentary also away. So what do we see about Rabban Gamliel? Number one, again, he's in Yerushalayim, he's a presence in Jerusalem, but he's not in Lishkas HaGazis. And another thing, what are we getting out of this in terms of what he's doing with this Sefer Eov? When he puts the Sefer Eov away, when he puts it aside and he puts it away, what's he doing?
Editing.
He's editing, meaning he's very much sensitive, let's say, to the struggle with outside influences. Right? This is the sensitivity that he has in terms of what he's allowing to be read and what he's not allowing to be read. And granted, he's not going to be crazy in terms of, you know, declaring this or that or the other thing. You know, you got to know where, you know, who butters your bread and who the power is. On the other hand, he's going to understand in terms of his responsibilities to Torah of seeing to it that it is transferred correctly and properly to the next generation.
Thus his words, just go put them away somewhere.
Exactly. Another really interesting Gemara in Sanhedrin, and here Rav Margolios makes the claim that this was of the time period of Rabban Gamliel the Elder. He says, "Ein Moshivin." This is the Gemara in Sanhedrin, Yud Ches Amud Beis, talking about who's allowed to be on the Sanhedrin. So it says, "Ein Moshivin Melech b'Sanhedrin, v'lo Melech v'Kohen Gadol." You're not allowed to put on your Sanhedrin a king, and not a king who's also a high priest. When was this, by the way? An issue? The Hasmoneans, right? They made the king and the high priest. They merged the two, right? They merged the religious branch and the judicial branch, or the executive branch of government.
Government.
Yeah, I don't know. They had a religious branch of government, right? But when were they permitted? The Ibor Hashana Melech B'Sanhedrin, right? When would a king be allowed to be put in the Sanhedrin? When they were deciding on the months. And this is one of the interesting things we're going to see with Rabban Gamliel. Of all the things that he involves himself very intensely, it's in Ibor Hashana, in deciding on the months, right? The Sanhedrin would decide
if it's Ibor or not.
Yeah, whether or not, you know, to add another month of Adar, right? This is always a big decision, right? You don't want the seasons to be off. They're very interested in not seeing to it. So when this decision was made, you would invite the king onto the Sanhedrin. This is a very sensible idea. Why would you invite the king onto the Sanhedrin?
He could alter it if he wanted.
What? I mean, also, it relates directly to his life. You know what I mean? You want him on board for this type of decision. It's just it's one of those. So this brings us to the Gemara in Sanhedrin Yud Aleph Amud Beis, which the Gemara there assumes that this is referring to Rabban Gamliel II, but probably, again, I go to Margolios for my source here, it's probably referring to Gamliel I, right? The one we're talking about.
I thought they wouldn't call him Rabban. I thought only the second one was called.
No, Rabban. Shimon. The first Shimon wasn't called, but all the Gamliels were called Rabban.
Even the earlier one.
Yeah. So it says, Masa b'Rabban Gamliel, Shayo Shriv Agav Male b'Harabayis. Again, where is he sitting? Not in the Lishkas HaGazis, but on this raised platform. Vaya Yochanan Sofer Halaz Omed Lefnanov. So there was this guy, Yochanan, who was this super-duper sofer, super-duper scribe, who was standing there. Vishalosh Igros Chatuchos Lefnanov Munachos. He had three separate letters to be sent. Amrlo, he says to him, Tol Igros Achada Uchsov La'achna B'nei Galila Ila U'la'achana B'nei Galila Tita. Okay, so he says, I want you to take two of these. One send to the people who are dwelling in the upper Galilee, and one to the people dwelling in the lower Galilee. Shlomochon Yaska Me'odon Anachna L'chon Dezamen Biura Mata Le'afrushe Masra Mimatana Dezesa. So he says, guess what? The time has come for you guys to take Ma'aser, to tithe from the olives that are growing up there. So basically, the tithing time has come, right? Again, the months were very much related to the harvest seasons, right? You wanted to make sure they were all in concert. B'tol igros achada, take the second one, uksov lachana beid roma, send it to the south. Shlomachon yaska, me'odon anachna, lechon dizman biura, mata, lafrushe masra, me'omra shibala. The time has come for you to take from the wheat harvest, to tithe from the wheat harvest. So send that to the people down south. And then what did he say? V'tol igris achada, take a third letter, and who should you send it? Uksov lachana b'nei galvasa b'vavel. So he says, take a third letter, and who should you send it to? To the people dwelling in Babylonia. And what should it say to them? Dibimadai, they're living, remember, paras umadai in Medea, right? U'lashar kol galvasa d'Yisrael, shlomachon yaska, how's it going? La'olam ha'adina nachnu l'chon digozlaya richichin v'amara arakin v'zamna da'aviva lo mata. What does he say? The buds are still budding, right? The plants are still weak, and the time of spring has not yet come. Meaning, what am I doing? I'm adding a month, right? Spring has not yet come, has not yet sprung, right? So what am I doing? I'm adding a second Adar, because I see that the plants need more time to grow, right? That's why they would add another Adar. So what's he telling them? Because they're not going to know in Babylonia. They have a different, you know, wheat cycle and barley cycle and seasonal cycle. You know, they're living on rivers. They're not living by the rain. So it's not the same type of experience. So they're not necessarily going to say, just so you know, we here are adding a month. Okay, so what do we see here? Rabban Gamliel was directly involved in Ibur Hashanah. Right, even though this was the responsibility of the Sanhedrin. So one of two things happened. Either he was doing Ibur Shana on his own, right? He was making these decisions on his own, or he was collaborating with the Sanhedrin, at least for this purposes. Another Mishnah. The Mishnah in Rosh Hashanah, the second parak, Mishnah Hay. So it says, Chatzer Gdola Haitza B'Yerushalayim. There was a great big field in Jerusalem. Uveit Yazek haitza nekres, and it was called Beit Yazek. Ulasham kol ha'idim miskansim, there all the witnesses would go in. Uveit din boskinosam, and the high court would check them to make sure they were good. And this was for the purposes of, right, the way they would decide on the month was two witnesses would say, we saw the first light of the moon, right, and they would be checked, those witnesses, and were it true, they would declare Rosh Chodesh to be that day. So, or the day after. So what would they do? Sudos gedolos osin lahem. They would make a big meal for them. Bishil shiyu regin lavo barishona. Right? This way they would come quick, right? Jews always come when there's food, right? Mm-hmm. So you want to make sure there's food. Veloayu zazim isham kol hayom. And they would stay there for the entire day. Right? Why? Because you don't want them to go anywhere. So hiskin rabban gamliel hazakein. So the elder rabban gamliel, what takana did he make? Right, he gave them, they could walk 2,000 amos in each direction, so they didn't have to stay in the same place. So to anyone on Shabbos, who was saving someone from something, he was also given 2,000 amos. Remember, there was the problem of Tchum Shabbos, right? You only have, so Rabban Gamliel allowed them for this. So here we see what? He is acting for the purposes of the Sanhedrin, or doing Sanhedrin-like actions, but what's he doing them? On his own. He's the first person who's making takanos on his own. I mean, I shouldn't say that. Hillel did make a takana. Hillel made Prizbul. But what's Rabban Gamliel and more, and we don't know about Shimon, but what's Rabban Gamliel? Rabban Gamliel is taking Hillel's style of leadership, this independent Talmid Chacham, this Gadol Hador type of leadership, taking it to the next level in terms of its ability and in terms of its quality.
Don't we have to assume that he had the permission of Sanhedrin to do all this, or at least cooperation?
He assumed it.
You have to assume.
So he was again, he became a de facto leader.
Right.
Meaning, by what power did Rav Moshe Feinstein have? By the force of his personality and his scholarship, right? That the two blended together and people just rallied around him in terms of
Sanhedrin to confront Rabbi.
Correct, but the Sanhedrin recognized it was a political organization now. They weren't going to be involved in these type of issues. And if they were, Rabban Gamliel would work with them.
Okay.
Well, by the way, does it give sources for the 2,000? Where did he get that 2,000 amos?
I mean, 2,000 amos is a classic number. It's a halacha Moshe Mitzinai number of between cities, yeah.
Wasn't the Sanhedrin at that point really not an independent body?
Unclear, but perhaps. But perhaps. And again, remember
that would explain why he was standing up as an independent authority.
Correct.
They were losing their authority.
Correct. There was no authority. Or if there was, it was an authority over other areas, you know, levying taxes, you know, those other things that were less. You know, I think this is even during the reign of Caligula, maybe? No, maybe Caligula's a little... No, this might have been during the reign of Caligula already, right? Turn of the century, turn of the millennium... I mean, there's Pontius Pilate, everyone knows him, but you know, the leadership at that time, or the Roman procurators, weren't exactly the ones that, you know, to write home about. There was one, I forget, Agrippus, I think it was, who was very good to the Jews, but yeah, who was good, but right.
That's probably the one. There's a street
right.
named Jerusalem.
Right. There's a street named Abraham Lincoln also. I don't know. Yeah.
Approximately, how many Jews still live in Babylonia?
A million, Babylonian community was massive. They were still there from the first temple.
Bigger than Israel?
Unclear. I know we don't hear from them for 750 years, and then they dominate history for the rest of it. For 750 years, the Babylonian community just kind of bides their time.
Hibernating,
and then somewhere after the Bar Kokhba revolt, they shoot out into prominence and make everyone look bad for the rest of history. But we're living off of their interpretations to this day. You know, the Talmud. So
evidently, he was held in such awe, even by Sanhedrin of the time.
Yeah,
he refused to confront them.
Yeah. I'll just give you a couple of other interesting areas where he is. The Mishnah in Yevamos, Perek Tzayin, Mishnah Zayin. I think I'm running up against some time here. So here it talks about Rabbi Akiva, who was dealing with the question of whether you could allow a woman to remarry, a woman who was an aguna, could you allow her to remarry according to the testimony of just one witness? And it is quoted here, according to the Mishnah in Yevamos, in the name of Rabban Gamliel the Elder, that one of his major allowances was that he allowed women to remarry based on just one witness. And he was kind of the inventor of that. So again, you see him here acting, this is a bold leadership opinion. Again, Mamzerus, the notion of making someone a bastard, or potential of making someone a bastard, was something that was taken quite seriously. And the fact that he's willing to take this type of decision upon himself is, again, very much indicative of his power in this area. So same too, the Mishnah in Gittin, Perek Dalet Mishnah Beis, says Barishona Haya Ose based in Makom Acher Mavatlo. Right? It used to be that you could make a basin in another place and undo a get, a divorce document from another place. And Hiskin Rabban Gamliel Hazakin Shloyu Osinke Mipnei Tikkun HaOlam. Rabban Gamliel says this, you're gonna create, you know, basically society needs there to be some sort of standardization. So you see here, I think this is one of the most interesting. You see here a struggle with standardization in a post-bureaucratic world, right? Without a centralized halachic authority, right? Any three guys with the first name rabbi, you know, can get together and make any decision. So Rabban Gamliel has to standardize this practice in terms of unifying things. And so too, he has a number of, I also brought here the Gemara in Gittin, Daf Lama Dalet Amud Beis, in terms of how to write people's names in divorce documents. Also, he had a lot of particularities in this area. And so what seems to happen is Rabban Gamliel is this standard bearer in terms of unifying, in terms of centralizing halacha, in terms of unifying halachic decision in the wake of the lack of a centralized halachic authority. He invents the notion of a Gadol Hador. He takes, you know, the leadership style of his grandfather and of his father, and he brings it kind of into the next level of leadership and understanding in that sense. So the answer of what was Rabban Gamliel's role? So Rabban Gamliel seems to be the de facto leader of the Jewish people. He's the minister without portfolio, and his ability to lead has very much to do with the willingness of the people to accept his leadership and the fact that, you know, the source of his character. And you see here, not that he didn't earn it, but the fact. My sense is that this was very much from the people, because you have here the Hillel, the Shimon, the Gamliel. They were looking, you know, in a world that was very swiftly changing around them. They were looking for someone, you know, who would give them a sense of stability, a sense of halachic tradition that they were losing without the Sanhedrin as a central halachic authority. And you see, Rabban Gamliel really provided that. Which is why the Mishnah in Maseches Sota, when it makes this comment, and we'll discuss about what it actually meant, hopefully next week, it says, "Misha meis Rabban Gamliel bitel kavod haTorah umesa tahara uprishus." When Rabban Gamliel died, so the kavod haTorah, the honor of Torah, was wiped out, and tahara and purity and precious and separation died along with him. And it's a fascinating, fascinating statement, and we're going to have to explore what that means, what the post-Rabban Gamliel world was. It was not, meaning Rabban Gamliel keeps the people unified. Even in the wake of the upheaval that's surrounding them, the forcible taxes, the very high forced taxes by Rome, the very uncomfortable relationships that they were having with the procurators, the vast amount of movements and sects that were being created daily around them, among them Christianity, but not just Christianity, but, you know, you have the Samaritans and all sorts of other movements, the Sadducees, the Baitusin, the Essenes, all moving around them. And Rabban Gamliel is kind of this stalwart of Pharisaic Judaism, kind of holding them together. Just as an aside, I think I've mentioned this before, but just so you see why giving halachic Judaism the blame for the murder or the crucifixion, I should say, of Jesus is kind of wrong, because the Sanhedrin that Jesus went to was not the Sanhedrin that was deciding things al pi halacha. One of the proofs of it, Margolios points this out, one of the proofs of it is that they killed Jesus on a Friday, which everyone knows the Sanhedrin wouldn't meet on Friday, nor would they crucify anyone. That wasn't a standardized practice. You have here a Roman governing body. That's what it was. Were there Jews on this body? I'm sure there were, but they were not the representatives of, I don't think, of Pharisaic Judaism. But you see here, Rabbi Gamliel is, again, de facto able to hold the Jewish people together. And in the wake of his death, you kind of have this crumbling. He's kind of the last line of defense before all hell breaks loose, and you get the great revolt that ultimately leads to the destruction of the temple. And next week we'll get to what the real meaning of this statement is, and you know some of the specific stories of things that went on in the undercurrent of pre-destruction Jerusalem and the society that was existing there. As we get to the year 70 CE. Okay.
Is it safe to say that if Rabbi Gamliel had not died, the way the last sentence reads, there would not have been destruction of the temple?
I mean, it's impossible to say something like that. It's like a what if. I mean, it could be that if a leader of his stature, who knows? Maybe his son Shimon was just as strong as him. One of the things we're going to have to find out is whose side was Shimon on? Was Shimon ben Gamliel on the Zealots' side? As many in the Shammai camp were on the Zealots' side? Or was Shimon ben Gamliel in the Moderates' side with Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai? Those are questions we're going to have to ask. And I don't know if there's a solid answer we're going to find. You're going to have to read the Gemaras and see the stories and see if you can restructure where he was from. Yeah, Lou.
If the Sanhedrin was in decline, and that was one of the reasons that brought Rabbi Gamliel to the fore, then at the same time, the avoda, the service in the Beis Mikdash, was in decline.
Yes, it was.
Also being run by Rome. So my question is there any opinion in these early rebellion at this point that the Korbanos have lost their importance, or that anything denigrating that, you know, you don't need to quite run down there for Pesach anymore, it's not what it used to be. Is there any indication like that?
So, an institution was massively on the rise at the end of the Second Temple period. And that institution was the synagogue. This is when the synagogue is created. One could make an argument that the synagogue's power and force was created by the disillusion with the avoda in the Beis HaMikdash.
So the synagogue rose while the Beis HaMikdash still was in existence.
Yeah.
It wasn't after.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. If you ever go up to Tzipori in the Galil, in the Golan, you see that's one of the oldest synagogues.
Yeah.
It actually, fascinatingly enough, doesn't face east. But its corners are pointing to Arba Kanfot Haaretz, to the four corners of the earth, northwest, east, and north, south, east, and west. So that's kind of one of the interesting things about the way it's facing. Gamla had a synagogue, Masada had a synagogue. All the places had synagogues, which means that already, and you see the Essenes, who were kind of they were already uninterested in sending sacrifices to the Beit HaMikdash. So all of a sudden you see, so yes, that was definitely going on, and that's something we'll speak about. The high priesthood was overtly purchased for money by people who were not halachic kohanim, possibly.
Just curiosity, did these synagogues, the multiplication of synagogues, did they produce leadership, halachic leadership at all?
Yeah, there was a president and a vice president and a board.
But
I have no idea.
Nowadays, a rabbi well-known, his shul becomes well-known.
Right, so I have...
That growth didn't exist.
I have no idea. I have no idea if they had a leader. I know you're going to see with Rabbi Gamliel II... that he's very, very much interested in making sure that there is religious leadership in every area of Jewish settlement.
So given the disapproval of the Pharisee leadership of what was going on in the temple, aren't there often references in the Mishnah, the Talmud, placing value on the recollections of how the avoda was performed in the Beis Hamikdash? Are they skipping back three generations, or are they really just capturing their best recollections of the most recent avoda services, which the rabbis at the time probably would not have approved of?
I mean, they weren't all bad. I can't imagine they were all bad. So I'm not 100% sure how they knew what they knew, or I mean, you see in the arguments in the Mishnah as to what exactly that they did, which means that their recollection wasn't total, or that they weren't necessarily trusting what was going on. So, but again, that'll be for next week's discussion when we see a little bit of what was going on, what it means when they say Mesa Tahara Oprishus, when impurity and separation disappeared, like, they really mean that happened.
It sounds like the introduction of the satellite million. Really.
Breakaway shul.
Pure shul.
Yeah. Miriam, did you have a question? It might have been Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel, who, yes. Right. So Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel, we're going to see, was a member of... No, it was a member of the revolt. So of course he doesn't want anyone to hear anything. They're planning...
I think the Sarnos, it wasn't him, it was one of the... It was a Kohen Gadol, one of the Kohen Gadol, and he became a Tzaduki when he was 80-something years old.
Oh, so I don't remember that one. I don't remember that one. But...
Right.
Fabulous.